Essays on Prophecy, Lecture 4.
I've entitled this lecture, The Untold Truth About Muhammad. Now, I want to be quite clear that what I talk about today, a lot of it is history, and so if you're bored with history, well, sorry, have a coffee or something to keep you awake. But it will really be in two parts. Today I'm talking about the untold truth about him as an individual. But the following lecture, Lecture 5, will go into something that needs to be understood, I think, by everybody in relation to your hesitations and fears or concerns about the mark of the beast. It's rather interesting. But unless I give a historical background to it, it won't be substantive. Lecture 5 would just fall apart. You've got to have the foundation built, and this Lecture 4 is the foundation toward what I want to talk about in Lecture 5. So bear that in mind as we go. And in Lecture 5, I will also have notes so that you can take them home and talk to your loved ones or whatever, or your friends, relatives about it. So you can, without actually printing out the lecture, I'll have notes to go with it. But I want you to turn with me to Daniel 12 and verse 1. Daniel 12 and verse 1. If we read the following vital information about the conclusion of this present evil age and the severity that will accompany that period of time upon the entire world. Daniel 12 and verse 1, at that time, Michael, the great prince who stands guard over your nation, will arise. Then there will be a time of trouble, troubling anguish, greater than any since nations first came into an existence.
You can't imagine it, can you?
No, you can't. You can't. But at that time, every one of your people whose name is written in the book will be rescued. Rather intriguing, the way this is written and codified. I'll repeat it. The great prince, Michael, who stands guard over your nation, will arise. Now notice he arises first. And in another scripture you find that Michael has a real shot at Hasatan. There's a great war in the heavens. And I think there'll be indications here on Earth with all our Hubble telescopes and goodness knows what other equipment we've got that we'll see that there will be something happening in outer space. There will be a time of troubling anguish greater than any since nations first came into an existence. Now, I try to get my head around that and you're sort of, wow, it must be going to be pretty heavy here on Earth.
I think, though, that they're in a different realm.
Sorry?
That we won't see that happen because it's in a different realm.
Oh, well, I'm talking about the anguish here on Earth.
No, but the angel. When the you angel, said that angelic we'll war. See something yeah. going on, but we probably won't because it's...
okay, whatever.
It's through a wormhole.
perhaps not. We'll see. One thing for sure, humanity will see Hasatan's arrival on Earth. That will be tracked. You will see myriads of shield-like flying saucers, you want to call them that, coming through space, heading toward Earth. Everyone will be aware of it. It says that. And when it descends, people will think it's the second coming of Christ, but I'll get into that later. It goes on to say, but at that time, every one of your people whose name is written in the book will be rescued. A lot of Jewish people don't like the job Michael did in the 1930s and 1940s, because he didn't look after too many Jews, millions died. But how many died whose names are written in the book of life? I would say none. Because it says here, as far as the future is concerned, and God doesn't change in his character at all, at that time every one of your people whose name is written in the book will be delivered, will be rescued. So, I believe that is going to be the case. In any case, a time of trouble is coming. But earlier in the scroll of Daniel, in chapter 11, and this is most important, The prophet was told that the earth's final conflict would involve a king of the north of Jerusalem and him coming against the king of the south of Jerusalem. A kingdom at the end of the age, which Daniel infers, triggers the northern kingdom into open war. Because Daniel says he pushes at him. So he's triggering the king of the north to come against him. These two Middle Eastern powers will usher in the coming of Christ, and it would be a devastating period through which to attempt to live. Now that's, people say, what's it going to be like at the end of the age? Well, Daniel 11 and Daniel 12 tell us exactly what it's going to be like.
And if weaponry keeps advancing the way it is.
Absolutely. But keep in mind too, that what we're talking about are Muslims. We're talking about Muslims. Yes.
So this time is troubling time in the Middle East.
Yes.
Or for the whole world.
Well, it says that troubling time will come upon. If you want to really narrow right into it, it's coming against the Jews. That's the Middle East. But you cannot have, in my view, troubling anguish greater than any since nations first came into an existence without that crisis involving the entire planet.
Well, that's affecting the entire planet now.
It is.
What's happening always affects the rest of the world.
That's right.
Even if it's the gas that you put in your car.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. So the whole world will be involved. There's no doubt about that. So how do we ascertain that these kings or kingdoms would be situated north and south, respectively, of the city of Jerusalem? That question was asked us recently, and I answered it a certain way. But precisely because the entire chapter of Daniel 11 covers approximately 500 years of ancient history being fulfilled in personalities such as Alexander the Great and Mark Antony and Cleopatra. They're mentioned in Daniel 11. And therefore, these ancient personalities and a number of others mentioned in the same chapter in the text are constellating about and around Judea. Now, all Bible commentators recognize this fact, so we're not unique in that, but clearly it's all about the south and north of Jerusalem. But the chapter starts, chapter 11 starts, with a nation. I want you to notice chapter 11, in the very first verses, that nation is Persia. That nation is Iran, ancient Persia, modern Iran. And it's in conflict with the realm of Grecia. Now that word, if you've got Grecia or Grecia in Daniel 11, replace it with Yavan, Yavan or Javan. Now those people were originally in the Balkans. And they migrated in the great migrations of a number of centuries ago. They went to Southeast Asia, and they are now situated in Southeast Asia, and even Java is mentioned there, and the Straits of Javan, they're all there. But we're talking about the Balkans. The Baltic states are situated in Eastern Europe, and Alexander the Great, who is mentioned specifically in Daniel 11, was not a Greek. When I went to school, he was a Macedonian. And over the years, he's been called Alexander the Great. He was a Greek. No, he wasn't. He was a Macedonian, and his father, Philip, was a Macedonian as well. In fact, Philip of Macedon, as it's referred to. But Alexander conquered the Persians, creating an astonishing empire with lightning speed. But when he unexpectedly died in 323 BCE at a very early age, without leaving an heir to his kingdom, the Macedonian Empire was parcelled up into four divisions between his four loyal generals, Ptolemy, Seleucus, Lysimachus, and Cassander. And there were other smaller fragmentations in outlying areas, mostly in Asia Minor, which is, of course, today is modern Turkey. Ptolemy took Egypt, Palestine, and southern Syria. That was what he had. Ptolemy took Egypt, Palestine, and southern Syria. Seleucus, his territory extended from Asia Minor, Turkey, eastward to nearly the Indus River, incorporating Babylonia, and he established his capitals at Antioch in Syria, that's 300 miles north of Jerusalem, and Seleucia on the Tigris in Assyria, which is near present-day Baghdad. Lysimachus held Persia, Thrace, and a very large region of northwestern Asia Minor, and Cassander was left with Macedonia and Greece. So that's the area we're dealing with in Daniel 11. But while all this happened historically, the entire prophecy of Daniel, if you look very, very carefully at the texts, which I might say many don't, it's not primarily aimed at the ancient past of Alexander the Great, but rather is projected into the future to the time of the end. So what many denominations believe about Daniel 11 is quite possibly and quite probably true as far as history is concerned, but there's a little verse in there that says at the end time when the Messiah comes, all this is going to happen again, which is what Christ was saying when he said Israel is the fig tree and all the trees are going to come back in a prophetic way. Alexander's immediate empire extended out into the rest of the world from the Balkans, not merely Greece. The very ancient peoples that populated the region were known as Yavan or Javan, for they were the descendants of Japheth, the son of Noah. And this is the term which Daniel the prophet reaches for to describe the area from which the last world dictator will apparently emerge. Now, I've been very dogmatic that it's coming from the Balkans. I've been very dogmatic about that for a number of years. But lately, I'm finding other areas of thought which need to be considered, and I'm going to maintain my view about the Balkans. But I will be giving all the notes necessary for everybody in relation to other areas of thought. All right? Because there are a number of issues that have troubled me personally over the last year or so. In fact, I've discussed previously, Greece is never mentioned in the original manuscripts of Daniel. While this is the case, Greece, which is an integral part of Alexander's empire, was admitted to the EU in 1981. Lately, it appears as if Greece may opt for a union with the East Balkan states and may well reject the euro. We'll have to wait and see how present conditions will play out. But these four Macedonian kingdoms, after much intrigue and war, after less than 40 years subsequent to Alexander's death, were reduced to three dominant powers: Macedonia, the Seleucid kingdom, which today covers Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Israel, southeastern Turkey, and Egypt. Egypt became, in a biblical prophetic parlance, the kingdom of the south. The kingdom of the south. And the Seleucid kingdom of Syria became the kingdom of the north. And this is where it becomes really interesting. Because out of the Seleucid kingdom came the seventh king of the north, Antiochus the fourth, Epiphanes. Epiphanes means the manifest God. And he was the template and forerunner of the coming Antichrist. I've written about that in the past, particularly in the Apocalypse series. Quite in depth, actually. He was born in the Balkans, but raised in Syria. Find that interesting. And he's identified on Seleucid coins always in association with the god Apollo. Now, there's another gentleman today who's on the world scene who is a mastermind and 47th president of the United States, and his penthouse is all done out in images of Apollo, which has made everybody think, oh, he's the Antichrist. Well, no, he's not. But it's rather intriguing that he does have roots in the Balkans through his family connections, and he has a real sense of ego, I'll put it that way. Antiochus, unlike the 47th president of the United States, Antiochus was mad. All right. So rather than pronounce his appellation as Epiphanes, the manifest God, the conquered Jews at the time referred to him as Epimenes, the insane. That's Jewish humour, of course, but that's what they called him. Antiochus Epimenes. Now, get to the point, for it is most vital to understand. It was in 65 BCE that Syria, the nation swallowed up into the territory controlled by Seleucus, or the Kingdom of the North, became part and parcel of a Roman province. Therefore, the King of the North was now the Roman Emperor Caesar. Now, this will figure very, very prominently and very importantly in lectures down the track where I give alternative views of the seven hills of Revelation. The seven, I won't call them mountains, but the seven hills of Revelation and what they actually represent. But keep these facts in mind as we progress through the series on essays on prophecy. So what I'm giving you in each essay has an accumulative effect down the track. So I'm writing from that point of view and lecturing from that point of view. Daniel 11, verse 40, ushers us into modern times. And it says, at the time of the end, in the latter days. Daniel 11, 40. So if the king of the south in Daniel 11, 42 has an alliance with Egypt, and it appears that he does, because the text states that Egypt will be conquered by the king of the north, then Egypt in no way could be the modern king of the south, which triggers the horrors of World War III. Clearly. Two other powers are listed in Daniel 11, verse 43, and they are Libya and Ethiopia. You'll notice that there in your Bible, in Daniel 11, 43. As the Antichrist swoops in with blitzkrieg speed, Libya and Ethiopia, it says, will be at his steps. Now, be very careful when you're looking at a free translation of Daniel. Be very careful, because Moffat explains they will be following in his train. To be at his steps, Moffat says they will be following in his train, following behind him. At his heels. Mm. But some free renderings make it appear that both of these nations, Libya and Ethiopia, will be aligned with the king of the north. But it doesn't say that in the Hebrew. Daniel is talking about these identities as being subdued by the Antichrist, not supporting his violent aim and goals. Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia cannot be inferred or implied to be that same king of the south that appears at the time of the end. They could very well, however, be allied with him. Without any doubt, we are discussing radical Islam as the king of the south. Obviously. Because all the kings of the south, whoever they are, Egypt, Libya, Ethiopia, Iran, all those areas, they're Muslim. What nation is today creating foment, agitation, aggravation all over the Western world as well as the Middle East, and is presently the greatest danger to a free world, and wants to obliterate the state of Israel and drive the Jews into the Mediterranean? What nation today could well be the kingdom of the south, whose mullahs delight in a religion centred in a death cult and promotes radical Islam? Iran, where Daniel 11 begins. There are almost 2 billion adherents to Islam. The religion of the 6th century CE prophet of Allah. Muhammad was born around circa 570 CE in Mecca. But most of Muhammad's followers, if asked about his immediate heritage, would erroneously draw the conclusion that seems at first to be so self-evident. If you say, what was Muhammad, they would say, oh, he was an Arab. He was an Arab. Well, I will surprise any disciple of Muhammad with a different account of his mother, blessed be she, and argue, though they might, they will not be able to maintain their ignorance once it is aroused into an acceptance of the folly of fighting and terrorizing the Jewish people and the state of Israel. And I'll explain that in a second. Although Islam failed to conquer the world, and especially Europe, through its violent conversion outreach many centuries past, German Chancellor and de facto leader of the European Union, Angela Merkel, opened wide the doors of Europe to a great Arab migration in 2015. Angela Merkel had a lot of kind-heartedness, largely toward Arab asylum seekers, particularly those from Syria. But there were also Iraqis intermingling with fleeing Nigerians, Afghans, and arrivals from the war-torn Balkans. But in contrast to Merkel's kind-heartedness, the Australian government under Prime Minister Tony Abbott created Operation Sovereign Borders and the slogan Stop the Boats. The coalition's policy to stop the maritime arrival of asylum seekers primarily from, but not limited to, people of Asian extraction. In spite of global criticism directed toward an apparent racist Australia, this nation has experienced considerable success in its multicultural experimentation and in definitely stopping the boats. While Australia could wallow in its success, Merkel had created a storm of epic proportions as 1.3 million refugees, again mostly Syrian, and again down the track, I'm going to be talking a lot about Syria and Germany, most important to know what's going on there. 1.3 million refugees, mostly Syrian, poured across European borders, which threatened and threatens today white Europeans being swallowed up in a cataclysmic storm of Arab resettlement and a consequent pursuit of a progressive white European depopulation program and agenda. We can pretend that doesn't exist, but we are talking through our hats. That's what's going on at the moment. And the Arabs themselves, once they had made it into Europe and were raping the women, were saying very clearly, we want to impregnate as many people, as many Europeans as possible, so that our population will soon be Islamic Europe. Sweden, almost overnight, became the rape capital of the world. Shocking.
This is only over a 10-year period a lot of this has happened. Yeah, absolutely. Very rapidly, hasn't it?
What the Muslims failed to do in conquering by the sword in ages past, Islam has largely succeeded through the means of mass migration. While there exist a number of very sincere Islamist officers attempting to reform Islam, and we've seen a number of them being interviewed by Rowan Dean on Outsiders and so on, there persists an aggressive element possessed with the frightening vision of a global caliphate yet to be forcibly imposed on Western civilization. They are doing so with the full cognizance of where such action will lead, inevitably to World War III, as Daniel prophesies. And all the necessary intervention of the Prophet Muhammad and Yeshua, called Isa in Arabic religion. Isa is the Messiah, is the Jewish Messiah, is Yeshua. And together, Muhammad and Isa, or Yeshua, will bring the entirety of the world into submission to Allah. And the word Islam in Arabic means submission. This is a doctrine shared by both segments of the faith of Islam, Shiite and Sunni. I have read the Quran from cover to cover many times in my life. And nowhere is Yeshua or Isa given a bad rap at all. And he is expected to come back with Muhammad to judge the world at the end of the age, after the coming of the Mahdi, the last great prophet of Islam to come in Muhammad's image. Although Muhammad is thought of by most people as an Arab, historians are recognizing that he was in fact of immediate Jewish and Samaritan heritage. Astonishingly, his mother, Amina bint Wahib, was a Jewish woman who had become a convert to early Messianic Christianity, and from whom Muhammad gained much specialized teaching centered in the Shema, the oneness and unity of the God of Abraham. It was Muhammad's desire to restore the original religion of Abraham and to bring about the unity of God, fighting against the Trinitarian doctrine of European Roman Catholicism. Rather interesting. 60 Centuries of Human Progress was published in 1901 in 12 volumes. The late Dr. Ernest L. Martin quoted from it prolifically. In the section dealing with the Prophet Muhammad, we read the following. Quote, "The Arabs have a sense of spiritual things, and this sense seems to have a root in their organization. The ancient religion of Arabia was the Sabaean idolatry, consisting of the worship of the sun, moon, and stars. But long before Muhammad's time, the Arabs were distracted by a great variety of beliefs. Some of the tribes adhered to their ancestral creeds. Others embraced Persian magism. Others, Judaism. While several tribes became Christian." Yeah, this is something that's been lost to the education institutes today, the story of early Arabia.
The Muslims wouldn't know this history, would they?
No. When Christianity was introduced into Arabia, it was unfortunately deeply tinged with men's devices. The various Christian Arab tribes were animated by a fierce sectarian spirit and hated each other more bitterly than Jews or pagans. The vivid imaginations of the Arabs caused them to investigate subjects beyond the powers of human comprehension, and the result was such a multitude of new doctrines that one of the early Christian fathers described Arabia as the country most prolific in heresies. Intriguing. To continue, "Thus when Muhammad appeared, the Arabian religion was a jumble of monotheism and polytheism, Judaism, Christianity, magism, and idolatry. There had been at one time a powerful and intolerant Jewish kingdom in Arabia Petraea. At another period, the Negus of Abyssinia had established Christianity in Yemen, or Arabia Felix, which is southern Arabia. But neither Judaism nor Christianity had ever been able to conquer the whole Arabian nation. And at the end of the 6th century, when Muhammad made his appearance, Sabism, or the worship of the heavenly bodies, was the prevailing religion of Arabia. Muhammad appeared about the end of the 6th century of the Christian era, and in a few years he united all the warring Arab tribes into one religious faith and consolidated them into one nation. His successors wielded their mighty and enthusiastic forces against neighboring countries, Syria, Persia, Egypt, North Africa, and triumphed wherever they moved. Muhammad, the great lawgiver of the Arabs and the founder of a religion which had prevailed over large portions of Asia and Africa for the last 12 centuries, was born at Mecca around AD 569. He belonged to one of the most illustrious families of Arabia. This family was of the priestly tribe of the Quraysh, and of the particular branch of Hussein, to which belonged the guardianship of the Kaaba, or Temple of Mecca, which contained the black stone, believed by the Arabs to have covered Abraham's tomb. The branch of Hussein also held the office of chief magistrate of Mecca." Unquote. All of that is rather intriguing, very interesting historically. Dr. Martin gives us a further essential background to this biography of Muhammad. Martin writes, "The original black stone, a meteorite, was taken away by raiders. The present one is a duplicate. Now, most don't know that. I didn't know that. So there you go. We should pay close attention to the origin of the Quraysh tribe to which Muhammad belonged. The priestly Quraysh tribe of Mecca, to which all the Arabs of the peninsula gave honour and respect, has a very interesting traditional history associated with it. Its ancient origin was from one of the most famous cities and regions of Mesopotamia. They were known to have come from Kutha. Kutha was a city located before the days of Alexander the Great, a few miles northeast of Babylon. It was one of the earliest priest cities of the world. It was formerly the capital of the ancient kingdom of Sumer, which came into being right after the flood. It was first built by Cush, the son of Ham, from whom it was named. And it was a city associated in power and influence with Babylon itself. The fact that Muhammad had his origin from a priestly tribe that came from the famous Kutha in Mesopotamia is a most significant bit of information. At the time of Muhammad, the city of Kutha had long ago disappeared. It came to an end just after the time of Alexander the Great, but for the Quraysh tribe to remember their prestigious priestly origin for the centuries that followed shows that they held their Kutha ancestry in esteem. The word Quraysh means the same as Cyrus in Hebrew, or Quraysh, if you wish, which means the sun, the sun. And they may have adopted the name in honour of the Persian king, because he restored the priesthoods in Mesopotamia to their former prestige and let peoples raise up temples and priesthoods in other areas of the Persian Empire. And when we were over in England, the Robertson and I went to the British Museum and we were looking at all these various stelae, and we saw the whole thing of Cyrus, the Cyrus cylinder, with the translation into English next to it. Very fascinating stuff. The Quraysh knew they came from the priestly centre of Kutha. This means that at some time in the past, probably a few centuries before Christ, when Kutha was still thriving as a city, some of the priests from that region of Mesopotamia moved into Western Arabia and joined forces with the people of Ishmael by marrying into their stock and becoming their priests. Now this is where it becomes interesting. Who were the Kuthians? This was a very common name among the Jews. With so many Jews in Arabia at the time of Muhammad, now remember this is all being drawn from 60 centuries of human progress, and Martin is commenting on all this. It's rather intriguing. How many Muslims today know that Arabia was full of Jews at the time of Muhammad, you know?
They would have the horrors,
absolutely. With so many Jews in Arabia at the time of Muhammad, there would have been no doubt in identifying the origin of the Quraysh priestly tribe to which Muhammad belonged. In Jewish parlance, a secondary name for the Babylonian people of Samaria that the Assyrians had brought into Palestine in the 7th century BCE was the Kuthians. Throughout the Talmud, the name Kuthians for Samaritans was a common one in regular use among the Jews. What this indication shows is that Muhammad was no doubt a descendant of the Samaritans, or the original Kuthians, from near Babylon, who had become the priests of the Arabs at Mecca. This means, though separated by 500 years, Muhammad was a Kuthite like Simon Magus, who was the first heretic mentioned in the New Testament. It blows your mind. This fact is not often realised by people, but it is an important one to consider, because Simon Magus and his successors can be shown to be the ones who corrupted early Christianity. Yes, amen. And now the same stock of people was about to give rise to another world religion by one of their descendants born in Arabia. It is significant that Muhammad, who was of Kuthite origin, though geographically and politically the Quraysh had long been separated from the Samaritan stock of people in Palestine, was to become the originator of the chief religion that would be the major rival to Judaism and to Christianity. Unquote. Now, for more details about Muhammad, you can go to Martin's book, The People That History Forgot, published in 1993. Fascinating read. But continuing with 60 Centuries of Human Progress, and I find this, I would love to get my hands on it, in 12 volumes, published in 1901, read by Theodore Roosevelt and others, studied by presidents of the United States. Quote, and this is most important, keep this in mind, you just heard that he has Samaritan blood, Muhammad. Now listen, quote, Muhammad's grandfather, Abd al-Muttalib, had held three high dignities, but he, as well as his son, Abdullah, Muhammad's father, died before Muhammad grew to manhood. In fact, Muhammad was 6 years of age at the time of his father's death. The chief magistracy of Mecca passed to Muhammad's uncle, Abu Talib, and the only patrimony inherited by the lawgiver of Arabia and founder of Islam, was reduced to 5 camels and a slave. Muhammad's father, Abdullah, was an idolater. But his mother, Amina, was a Jewess who had been converted to Christianity. That's why she was referred to as a Messianic Christian, a Messianic Jewish believer in Christ. I'll read it again. But his mother, Amina, was a Jewess who had been converted to Christianity and from whose early instructions the great Arabian prophet probably derived the religious impressions for which he was distinguished even in his boyhood. In fact, in Surah 2, verse 62, it says, Lo, those who believe in thee, Muhammad, and those and the last day, and love Allah, surely they shall be with their Lord, and no fear shall come upon them, neither shall they grieve. That's paraphrasing Surah 2, verse 62. And I had many opportunities, way back in FEBC when I was with them, to talk to some Muslims at the time and quote the Quran to them. And I always used Surah 2, verse 62 to show them that Muhammad's attitude toward Christians was basically, leave them alone. And Jews, leave them alone. Now we know why. And that is because Muhammad himself was a Jew.
Yes, they're connected.
Connected. Mm. Again from 60 Centuries, it says, Muhammad seems to have begun his extraordinary religious reformation by endeavouring to fix his own belief and to free it from the gross superstitions of his countrymen. Being the grandson and the nephew of the high priest of an idol, and powerful and revered for his connection with the temple of the Kaaba, Muhammad had too strong an understanding to discover a divinity in this rude emblem or in the idols surrounding it. His love of solitude and retirement aided him in his speculations upon the great mystery of the nature of the deity. This needs to be understood by Christians. Muhammad himself was a great thinker and a great philosopher, and he was sincere in his desire to restore the religion of Abraham, the oneness of God, the unity of God. Every year, for a month at a time, Muhammad retired to a cave in Mount Hira, 3 miles from Mecca, where he devoted himself to prayer, fasting, meditation. In the solemn obscurity of this retirement, he laid the foundation of his future greatness. There he meditated the scheme of his religion. Sadness came over him in view of the evils of this world. He beheld with sorrow the calamities of Arabia, the abandonment of its ancient manners, and the introduction of foreign customs. His Christianized Jewish mother had taught him that the Jews were still looking for the champion of Israel, and that Jesus had promised to those who loved him the comforter who should lead them into all the truth. Unquote. And today, Islam preaches that Muhammad is the comforter who is to come as Jesus, as he called him, predicted. Comments Martin, quote, Muhammad came to believe that Jesus was one of the most powerful prophets next to him, but that he, Muhammad, was the last to give God's final message to the world and to restore the Abrahamic faith. Islam teaches that Jesus did not actually die at the crucifixion, but that another died in his place to deceive the people into thinking he'd died. Jesus, however, in their view, is destined to come again from heaven and put down the Antichrist who will come to deceive the world at the end of the age, unquote. Now, please keep all this in mind for the future lectures that are coming, because it's most intriguing that we are faced today with the great enemy of civilization, Islam. No, I take that back. Radical Islam. I'll qualify it. Radical Islam. And that is why when I referred to Amina, his mother, I said, blessed be she. Because she should have been blessed. Back to Trump. The Trump ascendancy has sent shockwaves throughout the entirety of the globe. We can now anticipate right-wing political changes in governments across a number of nations in a domino effect. The Trump ascendancy has set the stage for the creation of a new world order that will arise immediately prior to the second advent of Messiah Yeshua. That new international economic order will be a productive and peaceful alliance of governmental organizations and internationally linked industrial, mercantile, and technocratic associations and corporations. The promise of a golden age for the USA is no mean cliché. Trump has already shown that he backs up his promises with immediate action. The Democrat Party in the United States is fractured almost beyond recovery, and the knives are definitely out, and boy, are they covered in blood. It may be years before a Democrat is again elected to the presidency of the United States. Having said this, consider, question, can Trump bring about peace between the state of Israel and the radical Islamic terrorist machine created by Muhammad? Answer. In order for such a messianic vision of the 47th president of America to succeed, the Arab states and Muslim populations will need to recognize a stark reality concerning which, at the present at least, they remain in total ignorance. The first of these realities is that Muhammad was Jewish. Now, in rabbinic law, if your mother was a Jewess, you were born and remain and will die as a Jew. Such an awareness would indeed be confronting to any Muslim. Would it not? At this juncture, I would like to zero in on a providential speech made by President Trump in 2017 at an Arab convention attended by representatives of Arabian peace-loving entities as well as Islamic Islamic terrorist sympathizers. Now, I don't know whether you've seen the video, I don't know whether you've read the transcript, but here it is today. Trump's speech on Islamic terrorism delivered in Saudi Arabia. This region should not be a place from which refugees flee, but to which newcomers flock, said Donald Trump on the Middle East. Author of the article, National Post staff, the Associated Press, published May 21st, 2017. 2017. Very few even know that this took place.
Yes.
President Donald Trump described the fight against terrorism as a battle between good and evil, not a clash between the West and Islam, in a speech delivered to Middle Eastern leaders on Sunday. The address was the centerpiece of his two-day visit to Saudi Arabia, his first stop overseas as president. During a meeting of more than 50 Arab and Muslim leaders, he sought to chart a new course for America's role in the region, one aimed squarely on rooting out terrorism with less focus on promoting human rights and democratic reforms. Here is the full text of Trump's prepared remarks, which was released by the White House. So I've covered myself on this now. I'm shown the, where this has come from, and I have every right to repeat it. So this is Trump speaking. I want to thank King Salman, for his extraordinary words and the magnificent Kingdom of Saudi Arabia for hosting today's summit. I am honored to be received by such gracious hosts. I have always heard about the splendor of your country and the kindness of your citizens, but words do not do justice to the grandeur of this remarkable place and the incredible hospitality you have shown us from the moment we arrived. But you can't knock that. He's come right in and said, thank you. You also hosted me in the treasured home of King Abdulaziz, the founder of the kingdom who united your great people. Working alongside another beloved leader, American President Franklin Roosevelt, King Abdulaziz began the enduring partnership between our two countries. King Salman, your father would be so proud to see that you are continuing his legacy. And just as he opened the first chapter in our partnership, today we begin a new chapter that will bring lasting benefits to our citizens. Let me now extend also my deep and heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of the distinguished heads of state who made this journey here today. You greatly honour us with your presence, and I send the warmest regards from my country to yours. I know that our time together will bring many blessings to both your people and mine. I stand before you as a representative of the American people to deliver a message of friendship and hope. That is why I chose to make my first foreign visit a trip to the heart of the Muslim world, to the nation that serves as custodian of the two holiest sites in the Islamic faith. In my inaugural address to the American people, I pledged to strengthen America's oldest friendships and to build new partnerships in pursuit of peace. I also promised that America will not seek to impose our way of life on others, but to outstretch our hands in the spirit of cooperation and trust. There's the art of the deal. He sets the stage. He's got the platform. He's got the foundation right there. Everyone by this time is nodding and saying, yes, wonderful, keep talking how great we are. Our vision is one of peace, security and prosperity in this region and in the world. Our goal is a coalition of nations who share the aim of stamping out extremism and providing our children a hopeful future that does honour to God. And so this historic and unprecedented gathering of leaders, unique in the history of nations, is a symbol to the world of our shared resolve and our mutual respect. To the leaders and citizens of every country assembled here today, I want you to know that the United States is eager to form closer bonds of friendship, security, culture, and commerce. For Americans, this is an exciting time. A new spirit of optimism is sweeping our country, and in just a few months, we have created almost 1 million new jobs, added over $3 trillion of new value, lifted the burdens on American industry, made record investments in our military that will protect the safety of our people and enhance the security of our wonderful friends and allies, many of whom are here today. Remember, this was 2017. Yeah. A lot's happened between 2017 and 2025. Yeah. Now, there is even more blessed news I am pleased to share with you. My meetings with King Salman, the Crown Prince, the Deputy Crown Prince, have been filled with great warmth, goodwill, tremendous cooperation. Yesterday, we signed historic agreements with the kingdom that will invest $400 billion in our two countries and create many thousands of jobs in America and Saudi Arabia. Unlike Trump, who never seems to have a problem with speaking, my throat's gone dry. Continue. We have also started discussions with many of the countries present today on strengthening partnerships, forming new ones, advancing security and stability across the Middle East and beyond. Later today, we will make history again with the opening of a new global center for combating extremist ideology, located right here in the central part of the Islamic world. Well, I hadn't heard anything about that. It's amazing. This groundbreaking new centre represents a clear declaration that Muslim-majority countries must take the lead in combating radicalisation, and I want to express our gratitude to King Salman for his strong determination of leadership. I have had the pleasure of welcoming several of the leaders present today to the White House, and I look forward to working with all of you. America is a sovereign nation, and our first priority is always the safety and security of our citizens. We are not here to lecture. We are not here to tell other people how to live, what to do, who to be, how to worship. Instead, we are here to offer partnership based on shared interests and values to pursue a better future for us all. Here at this summit, we will discuss many interests we share together, But above all, we must be united in pursuing one goal that transcends every other consideration. That goal is to meet history's great test, to conquer extremism and vanquish the forces of terrorism. Young Muslim boys and girls should be able to grow up free from fear, safe from violence, innocent of hatred. And young Muslim men and women should have the chance to build a new era of prosperity for themselves and their peoples. With God's help, you know, it's there. It's there. This was before the assassination attempt. This is before it. And God says, I'm raising you up. You're Rehoboam the second. You're going to bring America the last opportunity to repent. That's my view. That's a lot of others' view, too, I've found since. With God's help, this summit will mark the beginning of the end for those who practice terror and spread its vile creed. At the same time, we pray this special gathering may someday be remembered at the beginning of peace in the Middle East and maybe even over all the world. But this future can only be achieved through defeating terrorism and the ideology that drives it. Few nations have been spared its violent reach. America has suffered repeated barbaric attacks, from the atrocities of September 11th to the devastation of the Boston bombing to the horrible killings in San Bernardino and Orlando. The nations of Europe have also endured unspeakable horror. So too have the nations of Africa and even South America. India, Russia, China and Australia have been victims. But in sheer numbers, the deadliest toll has been exacted on the innocent people of Arab, Muslim and Middle Eastern nations. They have borne the brunt of the killings and the worst of the destruction in this wave of fanatical violence. Some estimates hold that more than 95% of the victims of terrorism are themselves Muslim. We now face a humanitarian and security disaster in this region that is spreading across the planet. It is a tragedy of epic proportions. No description of the suffering and depravity can begin to capture its full measure. The true toll of ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, Hamas, and so many others must be counted not only in the number of dead, it must also be counted in generations of vanished dreams. The Middle East is rich with natural beauty, vibrant cultures, massive amounts of historic treasures. It should increasingly become one of the great global centres of commerce and opportunity. He's talking about a Middle East common market, clearly. This region should not be a place from which refugees flee, but to which newcomers flock. Saudi Arabia is home to the holiest sites in one of the world's great faiths. Each year, millions of Muslims come from around the world to Saudi Arabia to take part in the Hajj. In addition to ancient wonders, this country is also home to modern ones, including soaring achievements in architecture. Egypt was a thriving centre of learning and achievement thousands of years before other parts of the world. The wonders of Giza, Luxor and Alexandria are proud monuments to that ancient heritage. All over the world, people dream of walking through the ruins of Petra in Jordan. Iraq was the cradle of civilization and is a land of natural beauty. The United Arab Emirates has reached incredible heights with glass and steel and turned earth and water into spectacular works of art. The entire region is at the centre of the key shipping lanes of the Suez Canal, the Red Sea, the Straits of Hormuz. The potential of this region has never been greater. 65% of its population is under the age of 30. Like all young men and women, they seek great futures to build, great national projects to join, and a place for their families to call home. But this untapped potential, this tremendous cause for optimism, is held at bay by bloodshed and terror. There can be no coexistence with this violence. There can be no tolerating it, no accepting it, no excusing it, no ignoring it. Every time a terrorist murders an innocent person and falsely invokes the name of God, it should be an insult to every person of faith. Terrorists do not worship God. They worship death. Very bold statements. If we do not act against this organized terror, then we know what will happen. Terrorism's devastation of life will continue to spread. Peaceful societies will become engulfed by violence. The futures of many generations will be sadly squandered. If we do not stand in uniform condemnation of this killing, then not only will we be judged by our people, not only will we be judged by history, but we will be judged by God. This is not a battle between different faiths, different sects, of different civilizations. This is a battle between barbaric criminals who seek to obliterate human life and decent people of all nations, all religions, who seek to protect it. This is a battle between good and evil. When we see the scenes of destruction in the wake of terror, we see no signs that those murdered were Jewish or Christian, Shia or Sunni. When we look upon the streams of innocent blood soaked into the ancient ground, we cannot see the faith or sect or tribe of the victims. We see only that they were the children of God, whose deaths are an insult to all that is holy. But we can only overcome this evil if the forces of good and are united and strong, and if everyone in this room does their fair share and fulfills their part of the burden. Terrorism has spread across the world, but the path to peace begins right here on this ancient soil, in this sacred land. America is prepared to stand with you in pursuit of shared interests and common security. But the nations of the Middle East cannot wait for American power to crush this enemy for them. The nations of the Middle East will have to decide what kind of future they want for themselves, for their countries, and for their children. It's a choice between two futures. It's a choice America cannot make for you. A better future is only possible if your nations drive out the terrorists and extremists. Drive them out. His emphasis, not mine. Drive them out of your places of worship. Drive them out of your communities. Drive them out of your holy land and drive them out of this earth. For our part, America is committed to adjusting our strategies to meet evolving threats and new facts. We will discard those strategies that have not worked and will apply new approaches informed by experience and judgment. We are adopting a principled realism rooted in common values and shared interests. Our friends will never question our support, and our enemies will never doubt our determination. Our partnerships will advance security through stability, not through radical disruption. We will make decisions based on real-world outcomes, not inflexible ideology. We will be guided by the lessons of experience, not the confines of rigid thinking. And wherever possible, we will seek gradual reforms, not sudden intervention. You know, think about this speech. This speech is
amazing.
It's astonishing. Any wonder they wanted to kill him? To continue, we must seek partners, not perfection, and to make allies of all who share our goals. Above all, America seeks peace, not war. Muslim nations must be willing to take on the burden if we are going to defeat terrorism and send its wicked ideology into oblivion. The first task in this joint effort is for your nations to deny all territory to the foot soldiers of evil. Every country in the region has an absolute duty to ensure terrorists find no sanctuary on their soil. Many are already making significant contributions to regional security. Jordanian pilots are crucial partners against ISIS in Syria and Iraq. Saudi Arabia and a regional coalition have taken strong action against Houthi militants in Yemen. The Lebanese army is hunting ISIS operatives who try to infiltrate their territory. Emirati troops are supporting our Afghan partners. In Mosul, American troops are supporting Kurds, Sunnis and Shias fighting together for their homeland. Qatar, which hosts the US Central Command, is a crucial strategic partner. Our long-standing partnership with Kuwait and Bahrain continue to enhance security in the region, and courageous Afghan soldiers are making tremendous sacrifices in the fight against the Taliban and others in the fight for their country. As we deny terrorist organizations control of territory and populations, we must also strip them of their access to funds. We must cut off the financial channels that let ISIS sell oil, let extremists pay their fighters, help terrorists smuggle their reinforcements. I am proud to announce that the nations here today will be signing an agreement to prevent the financing of terrorism, called the Terrorist Financing Targeting Center, co-chaired by the United States and Saudi Arabia, and joined by every member of the Gulf Cooperation Council. It's another historic step in a day that will be long remembered. I also applaud the Gulf Cooperation Council for blocking funders from using their countries as a financial base for terror and designating Hezbollah as a terrorist organisation last year. Saudi Arabia also joined us this week in placing sanctions on one of the most senior leaders of Hezbollah. Of course, there is still much work to do. That means honestly confronting the crisis of Islamist extremism and the Islamist terror group it inspires. And it means standing together against the murder of innocent Muslims, the oppression of women, the persecution of Jews, and the slaughter of Christians. Religious leaders must make this absolutely clear. Barbarism will deliver you no glory. Piety to evil will bring you no dignity. If you choose the path of terror, your life will be empty, your life will be brief, and your soul will be condemned.
Wow.
And political leaders must speak out to affirm the same idea. Heroes don't kill innocents. They save them. Many nations here today have taken important steps to raise up that message. Saudi Arabia's vision for 2030 is an important and encouraging statement of tolerance, respect, empowering women, and economic development. The United Arab Emirates has also engaged in the battle for hearts and souls, and with the US, launched a center to counter the online spread of hate. Bahrain also is working to undermine recruitment and radicalism. I also applaud Jordan, Turkey, and Lebanon for their role in hosting refugees. The surge of migrants and refugees leaving the Middle East depletes the human capital needed to build stable societies and economies. Instead of depriving this region of so much human potential, Middle Eastern countries can give young people hope for a brighter future in their home, nations and regions. This means promoting the aspirations and dreams of all citizens who seek a better life, including women, children and followers of all faiths. Numerous Arab and Islamic scholars have eloquently argued that protecting equality strengthens Arab and Muslim communities. For many centuries, the Middle East has been home to Christians, Muslims and Jews living side by side. We must practice tolerance and respect for each other once again and make this region a place where every man and woman, no matter their faith or ethnicity, can enjoy a life of dignity and hope. In that spirit, after concluding my visit in Riyadh, I will travel to Jerusalem and Bethlehem and then to the Vatican, visiting many of the holiest places in the three Abrahamic faiths. If these three faiths can join together in cooperation, then peace in the world is possible, including peace between Israelis and Palestinians. I will be meeting with both Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Starving terrorists of their territory, their funding, and the false allure of their craven ideology will be the basis for defeating them. But no discussion of stamping out this threat would be complete without mentioning the government that gives terrorists all three safe harbour, financial backing, social standing needed for recruitment. It is a regime that is responsible for so much instability in the region. I am speaking, of course, of Iran. From Lebanon to Iraq to Yemen, Iran funds, arms and trains terrorists, militias and other extremist groups that spread destruction and chaos across the region. For decades, Iran has fueled the fires of sectarian conflict and terror. It is a government that speaks openly of mass murder, vowing the destruction of Israel, death to America, and ruin for many leaders and nations in this room. Among Iran's most tragic and destabilizing interventions have been in Syria. Bolstered by Iran, Assad has committed unspeakable crimes, and the United States has taken firm action in response to the use of banned chemical weapons by the Assad regime, including launching 59 Tomahawk missiles at the Syrian airbase from where that murderous attack originated. Responsible nations must work together to end the humanitarian crisis in Syria, eradicate ISIS, and restore to stability in the region. The Iranian regime's longest-suffering victims are its own people. Iran has a rich history and culture, but the people of Iran have endured hardship and despair under their leaders' reckless pursuit of conflict and terror. Until the Iranian regime is willing to be a partner for peace, all nations of conscience must work together to isolate Iran, deny its funding for terrorism, pray for the day when the Iranian people have the just and righteous government they deserve. The decisions we will make affect countless lives. King Salman I thank you for the creation of this great moment in history and for your massive investment in America, its industry and its jobs. I also thank you for investing in the future of this part of the world. This fertile region has all the ingredients for extraordinary success. A rich history and culture, a young and vibrant people, a thriving spirit of enterprise. But you can only unlock this future if the citizens of the Middle East are freed from extremism, terror, and violence. We in this room are the leaders of our peoples. They look to us for answers and for action. And when we look back at their faces, behind every pair of eyes is a soul that yearns for justice. Today, billions of faces are now looking at us, waiting for us to act on that great question of our time. Will we be indifferent in the presence of evil? Will we protect our citizens from its violent ideology? Will we let its venom spread through our societies? Will we let it destroy the most holy sites on earth? If we do not confront this deadly terror, we know what the future will bring: more suffering and despair. But if we act, if we leave this magnificent room unified and determined to do what it takes to destroy the terror that threatens the world, then there is no limit to the great future our citizens will have. The birthplace of civilization is waiting to begin a new renaissance. Just imagine what tomorrow could bring. Glorious wonders of science, art, medicine and commerce to inspire humankind. Read again Revelation 18. Read again Revelation 18. It's a world at peace. The world he's describing is what is described as existing just before the second advent.
And look what that other lot did in 4 years.
All it took was 4 years to undo this vision.
Yeah.
Continuing. Great cities built on the ruins of shattered towns. New jobs and industries that will lift up millions of people. Parents who no longer worry for their children. Families who no longer mourn for their loved ones. And the faithful who finally worship without fear. These are the blessings of prosperity and peace. These are the desires that burn with a righteous flame in every human heart. These are the just demands of our beloved peoples. I ask you to join me, to join together, to work together, and to fight together. Because united we will not fail. Thank you. God bless you. God bless your countries. And God bless the United States of America. There's the end quote.
What a speech.
What a speech. That 2017. I first...
And what a vision.
It's... I read every word of that, I read every word of it again, I read it over again, and I read it over again, and I said, this has got to be incorporated into this lecture because that's
the
foundation for it.
All the impeachments to take his time away.
Absolutely. But he's back, and any wonder he's back with a vengeance.
Success. He's back with success.
To conclude this lecture, in our following lecture... I'll discuss a little bit of this. That speech, we must remind ourselves, took place way back in 2017. A great deal of troubled water has surged beneath the bridge of time since then when it comes to the radical Islamic terror machine. On 27 January 2025, Trump stated that he would encourage Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi to open his borders to a number of Palestinians. He also reiterated that he would approach Jordan's King Abdullah with a similar proposal. We shall have to wait to see the outcome of these intentions, but we should not hold our breath, at least initially. No Arab state at this stage wants to open their gates to Fakistinian Philistines. Only trouble will follow. As Trump gradually makes his mark on the global stage and in making the US great again, attitudes internationally will change profusely, and we can already ascertain that steps will occur that will bring about the change Trump desires to witness in his lifetime concerning a peace accord in the Middle East. Our immediate following lecture will consider the little-known advent of the forerunner of the prophesied and horrendous mark of the beast. A mind-blowing reality Christians and Muslims must come to appreciate in order to fully negotiate their destiny in these end times. Stay tuned, and this concludes our present lecture. Are there any questions on any of that that was delivered today, or that you are thinking about as a result of what was contained therein.